Now, for those of us who might not be naturally tech savvy, operating, installing, and learning about new functions on our gadgets might be intimidating and time-consuming, especially when many instruction manuals are only available online. Older adults may face even more obstacles, such as very small print, tiny buttons, and sounds that aren't quite loud enough for them to hear. Kathy Helgerson is the founder of Simple Steps to Technology, a small business in the La Crosse area that provides help for older adults to use and understand modern tech. Last week, Rob Ferret talked to Kathy about her small business helping to build that gap.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, talk about the sort of things you do with seniors. What were some of the first technologies you tried bringing in?
Well, I originally started my business working one-on-one with people in their homes, helping them with iPhones or smartphones and tablets and desktops and printers and smart TVs and Bluetooth in cars. And I also do programs in communities around the Cooley region. And I've discovered that there's not a lot of stimulation in our senior facilities, and that's recently become my passion to get these technologies that are available out there. And the first one that I came across was a company called Eversound. And Eversound is headphones. I have a suitcase that I rent of 10 headphones, and anytime I go somewhere to do an event in a community, anyone that cannot hear, it allows them to hear me through a microphone. And then I can also send music through the headsets with using my iPhone. And so I entertain them with lots and lots of music that they like to sing along to, that they like to tap their feet. Sometimes they get up and dance. So a lot of rec therapy going on there when they're using my headphones.
And I imagine an issue for a lot of seniors is going to be hearing impairment. And that can mean, on the one hand, they have maybe a harder time hearing things, but it's also harder to sort out different signals. So if they're listening to music, you know, just on speakers in a room with other sounds, that's not going to have the same impact. So this bringing it right to their ears basically is going to make a big difference, right?
It's immersive. It is. They like it because they block out the other surrounding noises and they're just more focused.
And do you work mainly with people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, or do you work with seniors kind of across the gamut?
Age 50 plus.
And a lot of people might have a stereotype of seniors that they might be scared of technology. They don't want to use it. Some seniors might not embrace it. But I know from my own family that isn't always true. So could you talk about how people react to this new technology?
With the Eversound headphones, when I walk in the door, if I have been there before, they're excited to see me. They can't wait to put a headset on. One gentleman, he wanted to listen to some Elvis songs, so I was playing Elvis music for him, and he would know the year every song was released. When I took the headphones off of him, he wanted to keep them on, but he said that he used to play with Elvis.
Really?
He did. I know. I have to go back and play more Elvis and hear his story.
Well, that's why he knows every year. He might have been there.
Yeah, he was there.
Yeah, tell us more about virtual reality. I haven't really tried it myself. What when you go to the seniors, what do they do? What are they wearing?
There's so many benefits with virtual reality for people with dementia and people that are bored, people that have anxiety or depression. And they're finding that it's also having effects on people that have chronic pain and possibly addiction. They're wearing a headset, and they choose with their eyes what event they want to experience. So there's different categories going from nature to travel to learning. They pick the category they want, and within that category there's 20, 30 different content items that they can choose from. One of the ones they love is the drive-through zoo, and you can actually watch the resident that's experiencing it reaching out to touch the animals as they're going through the drive-through zoo.
And I understand this might be a community of people who can't travel now. Their mobility might be limited. They have to stay home. So this is an opportunity to get out and virtually do stuff that they can't do anymore, right?
Exactly.
What kind of reaction do you get from people as they start to experience, apart from reaching out and touching the virtual animals?
The conversation, even with the headphones as well. When they take off the headphones or the virtual reality headset, they start having a conversation, talking, sharing their memories and things that have happened in their past.
There's something special about having that immersive image. But what do you think that is?
I think it's something that's being triggered. There's a lot of clinical studies being done. It is a new technology that they actually had the first annual virtual reality health conference at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in California in May. And the speakers and the things that they're discovering, this is going to be big, I think, for our seniors. And we need to get this out there in Wisconsin, Minnesota. We're not making it happen, but we need support. We can come up with creative ideas to make this happen. And typically you hear, well, our budget doesn't allow it. Well, let's find some creative ways to make sure this does start happening. They deserve it. They've had hard lives, and they don't know about technology. They don't know to ask for this technology, but we can be their advocates, and we can make sure it happens.
Are you seeing more and more technology tailored for the needs of seniors?
There will be, yes, for certain.
Yeah, I mean, just a little thing. Like, I'm not at that age yet. I know if I have to call tech support and read a serial number off the back of a thing, it's small enough that my 40-something eyes can't read it. Is the tech? Are you hoping that the technology starts to recognize those little things that can make a big difference?
Yes, I'm hoping that does happen. Alexa is another discovery. Oh, well, I have an Alexa at home. Do you have Alexa? Amazon?
I don't, no.
They're putting them more and more in facilities. There's a facility in Carlsbad, California that I discovered last week, and they have 60 residents actually have Alexa in their apartments, and they have 160 in the facility, and they actually have an Alexa club. And I watched a video, I posted it on my LinkedIn website, of people sharing what they love about Alexa, like getting the weather, playing some of the skill games for brain games. And they can get actual menu for the day in their facility. They can get what the activities are.
That sounds neat. Now, when you bring a new technology into a group of seniors, are people a little nervous about it at first, not sure what they're getting into?
Sometimes, but typically I think it's how you go in with the technology. I'm so confident and excited about it, I think they want to try it.
Well, is there a technology on the horizon that you are looking forward to checking out yourself and then bringing to seniors?
Oh, my goodness. This is all pretty new in the last 6 months, so I'm just excited to get the three items we talked about today out to everyone.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Rob Ferret speaking with Kathy Helgerson about her work helping seniors find joy in technology. Her business is called Simple Steps to Technology and is based in the La Crosse area. Wisconsin will be putting new requirements in place next year for its food share program. More people will be required to work to get the benefits commonly referred to as food stamps, and the number of hours they work may be going up as well. Governor Scott Walker and Republicans say we'll get more people working and using the program for a shorter period of time, while Democrats criticize it as an attack on those who need assistance the most. Dee Hall is the co-founder and managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She recently reported on this topic. Dee, good to have you back on Central Time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So what specific changes to the food share program will we be seeing next year?
So this was part of those special session bills that were passed in late winter, and the changes to food share, the ones that I wrote about, have to do with work requirements. So those would change from 20 hours a week to 30 hours a week, pending federal approval, and also would include, for the first time, parents who have dependent children who are ages 6 and older. At this moment, parents of children of dependent children are not required to fulfill the work requirement.
So has some level of a work requirement always been tied to getting food benefits in the state?
Actually, on a federal level, back during the mid-90s, when President Bill Clinton, a Democrat, was president, there were a bunch of changes made to welfare, and one of them was this work requirement put in 1996. What has happened, however, is over time, many states, in fact, most states, have exempted themselves either partially or fully from the work requirement for a variety of reasons, you know, citing a poor economy or lack of jobs or whatever. So Wisconsin actually was in that boat starting in 2002, and under Walker in 2015 is when this work requirement was reinstated.
So there has been a work requirement for about 2.5-3 years now. Do we know how that change in the program has affected how the program is working and the people who are in it?
So according to the state's figures, about 27,000 people have gotten jobs by participating in the Food Share Employment and Training Program. At the same time, about 91,000 folks have been, or 91,000 times, people have lost their benefits because they failed to meet the work, training, and work search requirements over a three one-month periods within 3 years. So those who are not able to complete the program or meet the requirements are actually taken off of the food share program.
And so you said food share employment and training program. What is the, well, the employment part is having a job. What's the training part of that?
So, the, as it's called, FSET offers some training opportunities for people who are participating. And some of the participants actually aren't even required to meet the work requirement, but they are participating voluntarily because they want to get some of this training. So, and there are mixed reviews on how well this training works. Some people are finding that they are getting jobs. For example, I toured a place called Just Bakery, where the people there are getting trained to become commercial bakers. And one of the men who spoke with us, who had a long criminal record and a very spotty employment record, had actually gotten employment at a local bakery after going through their 16-week program. So it's a combination of different types of services and assistance that people qualify for if they join the program.
So the people who are getting food share, how did they end up in the program to begin with?
So food share, I mean, if you're poor, you qualify for food share. And then if you are in this category of an adult ages 18 to 49 who has no dependents, you are required to work at least 20 hours a week right now. That will increase to 30 hours a week beginning October 1st, so 2019. So these, so as you mentioned, your options are to go ahead and get a job that, you know, you're working at least 20 hours a week. Or you can participate in this program, in which case maybe you're not working 20 hours a week, but maybe you're training for 10 hours a week, and maybe you're working for 10 hours a week. So it can be a combination of things.
We're talking right now with Dee Hall. She's one of the co-founders and the managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And we're talking about a recent piece that she wrote about changes that will be coming in for the Wisconsin Food Share Program starting next year. So, Dee, you talked to, you mentioned one gentleman at Just Bakery who went through the training program, was able to get a job in a bakery, it sounds like he was pretty happy with the experience. That's not the response of everyone who's gone through this. What are some people saying who do not agree with how the program is being run?
Well, there is an organization called Legal Action of Wisconsin, and they have filed a variety of complaints, primarily focusing, in fact, maybe exclusively focusing on a private company, a for-profit company that runs the FSET program in much of eastern Wisconsin, including Milwaukee County. And they report that many of their clients say that they're not getting specialized help, they're not getting a lot of assistance to find jobs or training that they find meaningful. Now, the state is saying that they have visited with those folks, they monitor that program, and they believe that they're actually fulfilling the requirements of their contract. And so there's a dispute there. I also did talk several months ago with a woman who was in the FSET program voluntarily. She has a daughter, and she stopped participating because the requirements for the 80 hours a month were so overwhelming compared to how much she was getting in food share that she ended up just getting a job on her own. But it barely pays enough for her to get by every month.
Well, and some of the issues that many people face in having a job is transportation, is childcare. It sounded in your piece that a lot of the people who even are able to successfully get a job, those basic living costs just eat up their entire paycheck.
Right. And so in this case, FSET, for example, will provide 90 days worth of assistance even if once a person has gotten a job. But if you're a parent with children, certainly 90 days of childcare is nice, but it's not going to do it for you. And as we know, parents who work, their work schedules don't always match up exactly with the school schedules, and so therefore they're going to need some amount of child care. And the question that the state is working with now is figuring out, okay, if we start requiring these parents of ages, kids ages 6 and above to participate, how are we going to get them affordable child care so that they actually, so that we're setting them up for success?
We have extremely low unemployment right now in Wisconsin, and proponents of increasing the work requirements and adding people to the pool of who has to work for FoodShare are saying, you know, there are all these jobs out there. Employers are dying to hire people. But is there proof that the people who are going through this program and the jobs that need to be filled are a good match?
Well, sometimes not, and that's what they're trying to, that's the gap they're trying to fill, and the question is, will they be able to fill it before somebody loses their FoodShare assistance? And so, yeah, sometimes it's not necessarily a very easy to identify barrier, but, you know, there are people who, for example, have been turned down so many times that they're very discouraged, or they were out of the workforce for one reason or another, incarceration or other issues. And now they're trying to get back in, and they're having a hard time getting their foot in the door. So the philosophy on the part of the Republicans and on the part of the administration is that, essentially, if we have to help them at least get their foot in the door. If we don't do that, then how are they ever going to even get started on this path to self-sufficiency?
And, Dee, is there a limit to how long people can receive FoodShare benefits, or is it as long as they meet the qualifications for the program?
As far as I know, that it's so long as you meet the qualifications. I mean, the ultimate goal is, with all of these work-type programs and requirements, is that people will work their way out of needing public assistance. But what the state's own figures show is that the typical person who gets a job under the FSET program makes about $13 an hour and works about 35 hours a week. And doing the math on that, they would actually still qualify for FoodShare. So in that, you know, critics would point to that to say, look, this is, you know, perhaps we need to do something else. For example, Democrats have been pushing for a $15 minimum wage in the state, for better mass transportation and more subsidized child care so that it makes it easier for people to go out and work.
Well, Dee, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Dee Hall is the co-founder and managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She helped us break down changes to Wisconsin's FoodShare program going into effect next year. How do you decide what restaurant to try when you're going someplace new? Do you pick at random? Do you turn to Yelp or Google? The world of online reviews is huge. You can read reviews before purchasing something online, before choosing a hotel, or even before choosing a doctor or taking a college class. But are we putting too much weight on those reviews? And what makes a reviewer trustworthy? Ulrika Gretzel is a senior fellow at the University of Southern California Center for Public Relations. She studies communication and tourism with an interest in e-marketing and e-tourism. Ulrika, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day to you. You've been studying this topic for several years now. What do you find so interesting about this system of kind of peer rating and reviewing?
Well, you're right. I've been studying this for more than 10 years now. I started doing some work with TripAdvisor in the beginning, and it has just become so ubiquitous in our life. Reviews are everywhere, as you said, and it's becoming more and more important. So we are now talking about a reputation economy where a lot of things are really decided based on reviews.
As you said, really everything, anything, everyone can be reviewed in some way, it seems. What were the first industries or areas that consumer reviews first became influential for?
Well, travel was definitely one of the first ones, and that's because travel is very, you know, information intensive, and it's experiential, and there's a lot of risk involved in travel, so people always needed information beyond what marketers were providing them. And so it started with virtual communities where people were exchanging information, and then that led to review platforms. But we see it in the online shopping context in general, because there is a lot of risk involved.
And it also seems like travel, especially, is also a high price item most of the time. So maybe there's even more desire to have information before making a commitment to something.
Sure, it's not only high price, it's also high commitment and high emotional involvement. If you go on your honeymoon, that's usually a once in a lifetime, maybe twice in a lifetime kind of thing that you're doing. So you need to reduce your risks, and you also want to optimize your gains.
Do we have a sense of what percentage of people are looking for and reading reviews before they make purchases?
Well, the short answer is a lot of people. In the travel context, we've been doing studies on American travelers, and we find that consistently over 80% of those who are online actually say they are regularly using travel reviews to make their decisions.
Hmm. And what are people looking for? So I can look at it a couple different ways, I think. There is, I don't know if I should buy a smart TV. I'm going to read reviews of a bunch of different ones and see if they seem to meet what I'm hoping to get in my next television. Or it could be, I'm thinking of buying, brand X, model Y, and I want specifically to know if that model is one that I should buy, if it's one that works well. Do we know what is driving people to read reviews more? Is it general research or is it very targeted?
I think it depends a little bit on their personality. So first of all, I think people who value the opinions of others are more likely to read reviews. But in general, as you said, there's two basic strategies. So they either are overwhelmed by the amounts of alternatives that they have, and they need to rule out some of them. And so it's really about more efficiency in the decision-making process. Or there is some real need for specific information, because you might have very specific needs. You might be traveling with a child. You might have food allergies. You might have a specific size. So people are frustrated with market information because it's not giving them that level of detail. So they read reviews to get that kind of information. But we also find that there's a third one, and that's sometimes people just read it even after making the decision, just to make sure, just to confirm.
And hopefully that's what they get, not a, I probably bought the wrong one.
Exactly.
It could go both ways, really.
Well, when we do our studies, we also have people say they have actually changed decisions and actually have changed bookings because they read reviews.
Well, and that's interesting, Ulrika, because that's where I wanted to go next. Do we know? I mean, this is obviously, there's a whole psychology of being a consumer, and there's a whole psychology of marketing to those consumers. Do we know how much those reviews that people read about a product or a service or a location, how much that actually influences their final decision? Do they really stick with what they read, or do they go rogue and make their own decision?
Well, the research says that it really influences people's decisions. So even those who might go into this process saying, well, I have my own opinion, they can be swayed by negative reviews or very positive reviews. And this is also why businesses are paying so much attention to reviews, because it really matters.
We're talking with Ulrika Gretzel right now. She's a senior fellow at the University of Southern California Center for Public Relations. She studies communication and tourism with an interest in e-marketing and e-tourism. And we're talking about reviews and how much influence they have. And now, actually, I want to turn to who is writing those reviews. So we've been talking about who's using them and for what, but a big part of this is that people are taking the time to write them. Ulrika, what do we know about who is likely to write a review?
Well, first of all, if you have an extreme experience, so either extremely negative or extremely positive, you are more likely to write about it because you feel compelled to tell others about that. But then there's also people who actually have been let down by businesses. And we know from research that they were let down twice. So not only did they have a negative experience, But when they complained about it, the business didn't do anything about it or didn't do enough. And so as a next kind of step in the process, they go and write reviews. Mm. But then, and this makes me really feel good when I do my research, there's a lot of people who just really, truly want to help other consumers. And they write them because they want others to have good experiences. And they also feel that they've been benefiting a lot from those reviews, so they want to give back to that community. They really see reviews as a public good.
And I'll say I have actually written reviews on travel destinations and, you know, restaurants, hotels, things to do. And that was totally my incentive to do it, is I feel like I've benefited from reading other people's perceptions of places. And so I do the same. And I have to say, I went to a fairly unusual destination a little over 10 years ago now, wrote some reviews, and that felt even more valuable, like I was giving back more, because there weren't 5,000 reviews of this one attraction. There were 3 reviews of this attraction, and I was the 4th. And so, and I still get actually comments and questions from people 10 years later about some of those destinations. So I think there is something to that, about feeling maybe not part of a community, but feeling like there's a give and take that you're part of.
Yes, and it's giving back to other consumers, but also sometimes giving back to the business. If, you know, you had a very good experience at a restaurant or someone at a hotel went out of the way, it's a way of rewarding that kind of service.
Ulrika, you said that there is definitely evidence that reviews influence us, that they do get taken into account as we make decisions. Do we know if we pay more attention to positive reviews or negative reviews?
In general, I think we pay more attention to negative reviews. And research has shown that, first of all, they're less common. Turns out that people write more positive reviews. That's sometimes surprising when I talk to businesses about it. But also because we want to reduce losses, right? We're more concerned about things that could happen that could harm us, and especially in the travel context, that can actually be bodily harm, right? You don't want to get food poisoning. You don't want to, you know, be assaulted if your hotel is in a really bad area of town. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
So that's the usual thing, is negative reviews stand out, and people sometimes even specifically sort them out to see what could go wrong.
We're talking with Ulrika Gretzel, Senior Fellow at the University of Southern California's Center for Public Relations. Much of her research has been on consumer reviews, which we're talking with her about today. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you use online reviews? For what kinds of products or services do you go to them for? Do you use Yelp, TripAdvisor, or something else? And do you find reviews to be helpful? Which ones are you likely to trust? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Ulrika Gretzel. She's a senior fellow at the University of Southern California's Center for Public Relations. She's sharing some of her research with us about how we use online reviews and how we determine someone to be a trustworthy reviewer. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you read a lot of reviews before making a decision? Do you write reviews yourself? And has a review helped you decide where to stay, eat, or what product to buy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Ulrika, we have Ryan in La Crosse on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I use reviews for everything, from what to buy to where to stay. But one of the first things I do is always sort for those negative reviews. But for me, it's about sorting for insanity. You know, obviously, an overall 4.4 score is better than a 4.2 score. But if you go and you look at the negative reviews in the 4.2, and it's people who are very clearly crazy or very entitled, you go to the 4.4 and those negative reviews are something that sounds very reasonable, then I'll choose a lower overall score.
That's an interesting perspective, Ryan. So Ulrika, Ryan is looking at kind of that number score, but then he's digging down to see, you know, is this being skewed? Is that number being skewed by some people who clearly were just not going to be happy with the experience or the product?
Well, Ryan, that's a very smart approach. I absolutely agree with you. And we see that in our research as well, that people say, they are actually suspicious of those extreme ratings. And so they need to kind of figure out, are these people just venting? As you said, is this a crazy person? And so what that tells us is that people actually are very careful when they read reviews and they don't take things at face value.
It seems like maybe ignoring the two opposite ends of the spectrum and really focusing on the ones that are in, you know, probably a fairly wide middle range, but you know, taking out the ones that, you know, make it sound like it's heaven on earth and the one that makes it sound like it's hell on earth, maybe the middle is the better, more informative place to be.
Well, the problem with that is that this is sorted by the overall rating, and we actually find that there is sometimes not a complete correspondence between that overall rating and what people say in the text. So I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, just go for the 3-star reviews, but avoid extremes also from the text perspective. And I think you get a very strong sense right away in terms of where people are coming from. What people tell us what they look for is pros and cons and detail. And so no matter what that overall rating is, for the text review, that really matters to them.
So someone might say, maybe reviewing a hotel, you know, the staff was extremely friendly. When I asked for, you know, extra glasses and extra towels, they brought them up immediately. It is a little noisy, so you might want to bring earplugs. So kind of a more realistic characterization of an item.
Yes, realistic and also contextual details. Like, you know, if you are that kind of person, if you are traveling with children, if you have these kinds of needs, you will have problems. Or it was fine for me because I'm a business traveler. I did not spend a lot of time in the room during the day. Those kinds of things are very important cues for people to make the judgments.
Let's go back to the phones, and Jody in Stoughton is up next. Hi, Jody.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, well, just listening to this, I often go to reviews, look for reviews. One thing that the person mentioned speaking now, the details are important. It can make or break if I go to a certain place or not, but I find them very helpful. I go to reviews to narrow down, like, maybe choices of restaurants, because in our area there are so many. And also, if it's something that is maybe farther away that I'm really not familiar with at all, it helps me, you know, decide if it's worth the trip or not.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jody. So Jody's saying look at the details. And Ulrika, that sounds like it agrees with what you were saying.
Yes, absolutely. I think those are all very good points. And it really shows that when we write reviews, we also should be careful to include those kinds of details.
Let's go back to the phone, and Randy in Madison is up. Hi, Randy.
Good afternoon. This is really timely because I had just been talking to a friend who was looking at a restaurant review. And the my experience, I went to a reading once by a fellow who's kind of a local conspiracy monger, and he actually admitted that after he got one very early negative review, he got all his friends to give them the highest, you know, 5-star rating. And these are people who could not have possibly read the book because it was just out of the presses. But like I said, he must have thought he was talking to people who were completely simpatico, because he just said he loaded up the high ratings from his friends.
Thanks for that call, Randy. And Ulrika, that actually brings me to a point that I wanted to make sure we touched on is how can we know what's kind of some due diligence we can do when looking at reviews to know if they're authentic or not?
Well, it's very hard for machines to make that kind of judgment. So all the review platforms have some sort of, you know, filtering mechanism, and they have editorial teams that make sure that there's no profanity and all those kinds of things. But ultimately, it's up to the human readers to look for those cues. And because there will always be reviews that make it through that might be what we call fake, because there's no actual purchase behind them.
One of the interesting things about reviews, I think, is it can feel easier, I think, to write a bad review of, say, you know, a product that is made by a huge multinational company. But then when you come down to a much more micro level, and maybe you're reviewing your driver on Uber or Lyft or an Airbnb host who it's actually their home, that's an actual individual person. Is it harder for people to make those bad reviews when it could have a huge impact on another human being?
Yes, absolutely. And we see that actually, especially in what we call bilateral review systems, where you review and the other person reviews you. So your driver also gives you a review, your host gives you a review. Then people actually are very careful in terms of what they say, even though usually you won't be seeing that other person's review before you submit yours. And we are actually seeing now what I call review or rating inflation, in that, a 4.5 on Uber is actually not that great if you think about it. And if someone just has a 4.2, you already get nervous.
And that's out of 5 points.
Yeah, exactly. So we see that people are not using that a full spectrum of ratings for Uber and Airbnb.
And Ulrika, you've been studying this for a long time, and certainly this area of reviews has grown exponentially, probably beyond even you ever imagined. Where do you see this going in the next, 3, 5, 10 years?
Well, the big change we are seeing right now is the mobile reviews. So people are not sitting down in front of their computer anymore, thinking very carefully about what to write. They are being prompted by their Android phone, by all sorts of platforms, by Uber, to immediately provide ratings and comments. And so that means that, first of all, they're doing it while that experience is still ongoing or is still very fresh. And we know from psychology that actually our view of experiences becomes more positive the longer they are in the distance, right? So I think that will affect us a lot. But also we have now more evidence. We have location-based evidence, right, that someone was actually in a restaurant at that time. And so that serves as a form of verification.
And also verified purchases on, for instance, Amazon.
Correct.
Well, Ulrika, thank you so much for joining us. It was a really interesting conversation.
Well, thank you. I always have fun talking about my research.
That was Ulrika Gretzel. She's senior fellow at the University of Southern California Center for Public Relations. She studies communications and tourism with an interest in e-marketing and e-tourism. She joined us to talk about the culture of online reviews and how we as consumers use them to make purchasing decisions.